The 1999 murder of Haman Lee in Baltimore, Maryland, and the prosecution and conviction of Adnan Syed and her murder has now been documented in multiple podcasts with dozens and dozens of episodes. It's been written about in hundreds of articles. It's been covered by every major news outlet and has launched a global movement for justice. And yet, there is much more to the story, including Adnan's own telling of it. St. Martin's Press brings you Adnan's Story, Murder, Justice, and the Case That Captivated a Nation, the first and seminal book about the case that I was honored to write with contributions from Adnan himself. The book releases September 6, 2016, but is already available for pre-order. Go to www.adnanstory.com to place your order and reserve your copy today. This week's episode is brought to you by Stamps.com. You know that feeling of getting things done with just the click of your mouse? It can't get much more convenient than that. Now, get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk using Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your computer and printer. Right now, if you sign up for Stamps.com and you use my promo code undisclosed for the special offer, you're going to get a 4-week trial and $110 in bonuses, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com and enter undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to another special episode of Undisclosed. This week's episode is Military Justice. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. I'm joined with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogged The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Now, if you have been listening to the second season of Serial, today's episode is going to be of particular interest to you. Because today, Susan and Colin are not only going to be talking about the Bo Bergdahl case, but they'll be talking about an entire host of issues that are involved in the military justice system. Now, we've learned a lot in the last couple of years through Adnan's case and others about the kinds of challenges and pitfalls and issues that are plaguing the criminal justice system for civilians. But what about our hundreds and thousands of servicemen and women who also have to face a system, a criminal justice system within the military, if they're charged with committing crimes? So I'm excited to hear Susan and Colin interview one of the best-known JAG attorneys in the country, James Wyrick.
Wyrick. Hello and welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, Wyrick, could you give us a snapshot of your background and involvement in the military justice system?
Oh, happy to, Colin. I'm a retired lieutenant colonel, judge advocate. That's the Marine Corps version of a JAG. I've served as a trial prosecutor. I have a defense counsel, appellate counsel. I've prosecuted in Guantanamo Bay. I've been lent out to the State Department to go and check on our service members in mostly Japanese jails. So I've done almost every job that there is in the military justice system, and I retired about a year ago.
And so the reason that you are involved with all of this is that you write at the Task and Purpose website and are one of the three participants on the Task and Purpose podcast. So can you tell us a bit about the website and the podcast?
Task and Purpose started as for the new veteran, and being millennials or the young returning veteran, they've been very kind to me over there. Both Lauren Katzenberg and Brian Adam Jones, they've been great to me. They allowed me to write there for a while. And then starting in the second season of Serial, Lauren approached me and former Army Captain Nate Bethay, who was actually in Afghanistan with Bo Bergdahl, and we followed the case. And we're coming back. We took a hiatus at the end of Serial, and we just got signed for another 6-episode run. From now on, Task and Purpose Radio will be more military and veteran-centric, but not as much legal.
And in terms of that second season of Serial, the Bo Bergdahl case, obviously something that, unlike the Adnan Syed case, the Bo Bergdahl case is something where a good deal of the population knew about it. But I think really that knowledge is deceptive in a sense because there's so much more below the surface. And from your perspective, you not only have listened to Serial but also combed through all the documents. What are some surprising things about the case that people might not know?
Well, I think you've hit it right on the head, Colin, that especially our listenership at Task and Purpose, we had a large number of military listeners. And I think that they half know things. I think that from misinformation or misunderstanding, you had the idea that Bergdahl left to go and help the Taliban, that he was a traitor and betrayed his country, that he was working for them and giving the Taliban information. None of that seems to be true. I think the last portion, and I think the part that's going to be most difficult for people that want closure for the Bergdahl case, is the concept that we're going to get this final closure where they say, well, Bo Bergdahl walking off of the base caused this number of deaths. And both for evidentiary and discovery issues due to all the classification, that's just not going to happen. Or if it does, it's going to be many, many months from now.
Yeah, and that's one of the surprising things that was brought up in Serial, and I know you mentioned this before, which is that the Article 32 officer in the case, essentially, this was General Dahl, Lieutenant General, said, I was told not to look into the issue of whether anyone died looking for Bergdahl. And is that sort of in the sense that you mentioned where, based upon that, there's not really a way to get closure on this?
Yes, and just to clarify, Lieutenant General Dahl was the initial investigating officer. He did say that he was not tasked to look into that. The Article 32 officer was, I don't recall his name, but he's an Army Lieutenant Colonel lawyer. But they both made similar recommendations to General Abrams, who is the convening authority or the equivalent of a U.S. attorney.
And I've heard you mention this before. You made a reference to the Palsgraf case, and I use actually the same analysis in my criminal law class. And I, from your perspective, all the time that you've served in the military, the question there is the whole idea of the butterfly effect, in the sense that did he put the people at risk and did he put their lives in danger? But how do you disaggregate that and separate that from just the inherent danger that they were in their position, period?
Just as the conductors wouldn't have known that that passenger was holding fireworks, how can they be responsible for that scale falling on Mrs. Falsgraf? And I think that you both have the problem, and in the last episode of Serial, you saw this. You have the problem of just people wanting to say, well, obviously he caused deaths. And you had Lieutenant General Flynn saying this, where he gave an explanation and said, well, if somebody was walking down the road looking for Bergdahl and hit an IED, I connect the dots, you know, Bergdahl caused that death. But as you and I know, that's not how the law works. You need to say who died, how did he die? You need to provide all of that, especially problematic for this case, is providing all the discovery necessary for Bergdahl's team to disprove that there's that causal connection, that but-for connection between Bergdahl leaving and a soldier dying.
Yeah, and you mentioned that discovery, which, I mean, the title of our podcast is Undisclosed, and it deals to a large extent with what was not turned over in discovering the Adnan Syed case. And that takes me to probably the case for which you're most famous, and that is the case involving the individuals in the Marine Corps who were charged in connection with this video that was online. Could you tell us a bit about that case and your connection to it?
Yeah, there was a video online of Marines urinating or appearing to urinate on Taliban bodies in Afghanistan. This is about 4 years ago. That case was originally sent to one three-star general. The commandant had a conversation with that first three-star general and ended up moving the case to my three-star general, who I was working for as the equivalent of in-house counsel. And there were documents detailing why that move was done, and those were never turned over to the accused. We have a concept in military justice that's called unlawful command influence. That means that somebody is trying to influence the outcome of a trial or a court-martial. That can either be apparent unlawful command influence or actual. Definitely the discovery of moving between generals was evidence of apparent unlawful command influence, and it was never turned over. And that's why I launched the DOD investigation that eventually caused a lot of pain and heartache, but I was able to save those Marines from undue and unfair prosecution.
And you've been labeled in some quarters as a whistleblower. Is that a label that you agree with? It's sort of a loaded word in a certain sense. It's been used for people who have acted for good and in some senses in bad. I mean, is that the way that you view yourself in connection with that case?
I know what you mean, that it's taken on two definitions. I very much embrace the statutory definition because that affords me protections for doing what I did. But I don't mind it in the overall sense. But I know that there's been a number of other people that have claimed to be whistleblowers. You can talk about Snowden and Manning. So I don't mind it, but I don't want to be lumped in with those people that didn't necessarily do it the correct way.
Is there any way, and it's probably beyond your abilities, I don't know, to summarize a
Nothing
basic
is.
Description. Well, can you give a thumbnail sketch of what the basic differences are between the military justice system and our civilian justice system?
Absolutely. I'll try to do my best. For the federal system, because there's such variation between states, for the federal system, the military justice system is very similar. We operate under the same rules of evidence, similar but different rules of procedure, but there's a few really distinct differences that I think are at the crux of a national debate about what should occur with the military justice system. One is commanders controlling the juries. Just as an aside, for all the military justice practitioners out there, I know I'm using common phrases, but I'm trying to a certain extent not get caught up in the lexicon of military justice and simplify this. Juries, or members, as we call them in the military, they're selected and assigned by the commanding officer. And if you looked at that in the sense of the federal system, that means you would have that U.S. attorney, people that worked for that U.S. attorney serving on the jury. Another problem you have in the military, or a dissimilarity, is the Article 32 investigation. Some people will say that this is equivalent of a grand jury indictment, but in one very important difference, the convening authority or commander can overrule the 32 officer. It's as though the grand jury failed to indict someone. You just can't have the U.S. attorney then indict them over that overruling. For the most part, procedure and the rules of evidence are very similar other than that. There's some differences around the edges, but I did a lot of work with U.S. attorneys or assistant U.S. attorneys when I was down in Guantanamo Bay, and we functioned very similar to each other. But I would say that the commander's control of the jury system and the commander's ability to overrule advice are the biggest differences. Other than that, you obviously just have, you know, you can watch A Few Good Men and see the pomp and circumstance and the uniforms we wear.
What's the historical basis for the jury selection from commanders?
Well, not to go back too far with the rules of courts martial, but it's the commander just has dominion over all of them. And he's supposed to choose those most qualified because of their education, background, and select those most qualified to judge a court martial. And I think that that's something that remains under attack. We still have, I think that the things that I've outlined are some of the larger systemic issues for the military justice system. There's been a lot of band-aids put on that to try to make end runs around that. But unfortunately, I don't know that those band-aids are quite enough. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. And I mean, historically, my understanding is that this idea of unlawful command influence, that was the basis for this Uniform Code of Military Justice. But as you say, it seems a lot of these measures that have been taken to ensure that this influence isn't in place are more band-aids than looking at it holistically.
I try to explain it this way. So before World War II, it was even more commander directed. You had, you know, judges and you had non-lawyers working on courts martial. In World War II, we had round numbers about 2 million courts martial. That resulted in around 80,000 felony convictions for service members. So those service members come back. They, you know, become prominent members of society. They go to Congress. So in the 1950s, you have a revamping of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. What those service members viewed as the heavy-handedness of the military justice system was to be fixed. I think now we're at another one of those crossroads. We have the young men and women joining the service, either enlisting or getting commissioned. Our country's been at war since they were 3 or 4 years old. And they're really quite an incredible generation to know that they are going to be involved in conflict, and that's all they've ever known. And this is another unique time that we can just really, we're just guaranteeing them more due process in the way that their criminal cases are handled.
I'm just surprised I haven't heard more about this or had it come up more often. Because it seems like there are some serious issues affecting lots of people here, but these aren't stories that you hear very often.
I think as you and Rabia and Colin have done, and the people at Serial, all of us live this, but the general public, they might not know about discovery and Brady violations and all the things that you've turned up in the Anand Syed case. I think if you take that and then take a smaller sliver of criminal justice, that's military criminal justice. And as we said earlier, we're kind of shrouded in a bit of mystery because of this strange lexicon and people don't really understand it. And I think that's why it doesn't always translate well into digestible stories that you could know about as a larger public.
Yeah, and some of the stories that have been reported have dealt with the endemic problem of sexual assault in the military. And that has prompted this Military Justice Improvement Act that has sort of languished there in Congress. And so can you tell us a bit about this proposal by Senator Gillibrand and its current status?
Senator Gillibrand's proposal had twice failed to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. I believe it got 55 votes during the last 2 years in the National Defense Authorization Act. To a great extent, it is revamping and taking that prosecutorial power away from commanders. And remember, commanders are experts in tanks and airplanes and ships and infantry, and putting it into experts that are trained lawyers. The best way I can explain why it's stalled is just it's part of the military. The military is, and to a certain extent, rightfully so, very slow to change. If this worked last year, let's always keep it like that because I don't want it to not work next year when we're at war. For that same reason, the military opposed desegregation, opposed women in the military, opposed open service of homosexuals in the military, you know, opposed women in the infantry. So I think what Senator Gillibrand is doing is fantastic and needs to be done because the military, one thing they're not good at is prognosticating about the effects of change. You know, you'll see retired generals and admirals say that, well, if this happens, it will destroy the military. You can see 4 years ago, there were over 1,000 admirals and general officers that signed petitions saying, if we do away with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it will break the all-volunteer military force. It hasn't happened.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I recall when there was the discussion about Don't Ask, Don't Tell and homosexual individuals serving in the military, a lot of people would cite to other countries and their experiences with having gays in the military and how that didn't adversely affect the system. And this Military Justice Improvement Act, you co-authored a piece, Sexual Assault in the Military and the Unlawful Command Influence, Catch-22. And in that piece, when you talk about this act, you look at other countries, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, etc. And what was your takeaway from looking at other countries where there's been this decoupling of a lot of criminal justice cases from the military justice system?
Well, yeah, and I was lucky to be joined. My co-author is Dr. Joyner, who was an Army officer, just straight infantry officer. And we had both kind of come to this conclusion that look at all of our NATO and other allies. They have decided that our malum prohibitum, our felony cases, should be removed from the military and conducted by civilian prosecutors. There are some differences between the Canadian system, British, but by and large, that's the determination they've made. And we, for a dozen years now, have been operating alongside them and have not had, it's not as though we have hordes of criminals, you know, from Canada, or our British soldiers and sailors are just at large. Our modern militaries have seen that separating military justice from good order and discipline and turning over actual criminal acts, the murders, the rapes, those type of prosecutions are best handled by civilian authorities.
From my perspective, purely civilian background, to me that seems kind of obvious that it makes more sense to handle it that way. But like, what's the counter argument? Why would the military prefer to have what seems to be like a routine criminal matter still handled by a military tribunal?
I think your point of view is fair, and that's I never ask a woman her age, but I think that, you know, you've been around and seen for the last 15 years all voluntary professional militaries. The reason there was rougher justice in the military, you know, going back 200 years, is you had large conscript armies of people that might not want to be there at all. So there was a lot of deference given to the military to discipline in the way that they needed to ensure good order and discipline and ensure the proper working of the military. And that's the argument that remains. And you can see that in one of the counterpieces by Mr. Dunlap to my piece in War on the Rocks. This stress on, well, the commander's in charge of everything. And if that commander, if he or she doesn't have the ability to prosecute a case, then everything falls apart. I think that's taking it too far. There's no real empirical evidence of that. It just tends to be the gut feeling of, oh, well, I was a commander, I felt like this, and therefore we shouldn't change it.
And I wonder why, like, there's so many parallels between the problem with sexual assault on college campuses and the military. There was that documentary last year, The Hunting Grounds, and it's all about how the college justice system is inadequate, both in terms of prosecuting, but also the due process isn't necessarily there. And then you look at the statistics in the military, and you know, there's this study that came out about victims of sexual assault in the military are 12 times more likely to be retaliated against compared to the chances of the attacker actually being convicted. I mean, as much as we talk about things like the Military Justice Improvement Act and what it can do on the back end, what do you think can be done? Because it just seems that this is, as I said before, an endemic problem. You know, what can be done culturally? What can be done within the military to in some way reduce this very real issue that's been there for decades?
I'll tell you, Colin, I really disagree with especially the on-campus means of dealing with sexual assault and rape. For the exact reasons you mentioned, you have the due process argument. And then you also have, I believe, it's the minimization of what a sexual assault is. If there was a murder on campus, you wouldn't for a moment think, oh, well, we'll just have a student council hearing on this and somebody might get suspended for a semester. That would be unthinkable. But that's what we've done with the campus sexual assault cases. Sexual assault is a very real criminal issue that needs to be dealt with by trained prosecutors, trained investigators. And I think that the more professional we make it with medical examinations and looking at all of our best ways of approaching this subject, that will help both the military and the college campus. Unfortunately, and again, this is my own private opinion, but unfortunately, we can address things and hope to minimize them, but criminal acts like this are just part of the human condition, and we need to remove those people and punish them after it happens. You know, we would like to stop murders, but we don't have Tom Cruise traveling back in time yet. We don't have the Minority Report.
Yeah, and speaking of another Tom Cruise role, you mentioned A Few Good Men earlier. And you know, to a certain extent, when we're talking about these things, whether it be serial or some of the cases you've been involved in, obviously, what we're dealing with the negative aspects. There are, of course, many positive aspects, and I come from a military family and have great respect for the military, and I have many students here at South Carolina interested in becoming JAGs and in being involved in military justice. So what can you tell us about the reality versus the perception? You know, people watch shows like JAG, or they watch A Few Good Men. You obviously were a judge advocate general for many years, including in Guantanamo Bay. What was your experience like serving as a JAG?
I love it. I loved it. I would do it again. In fact, one of my mentors and continues to be my friend, now retired Captain David Iglesias, eventually became the U.S. attorney for one of the U.S. attorneys for New Mexico. He was actually Tom Cruise. He was the defense attorney that Alan Sorkin based that character off of. And you meet great people. It's a fantastic way of life. I recommend it. I'm just recommending some structural changes that would assist the system. For example, there's many great federal prosecutors and federal judges, but it would be a mistake if we were to do away with lifetime tenure for judges. It's not a reflection on individuals. It's more my view on changing the system is to put in place more structural protections for the accused and the victims so that everybody's getting a fairer type of justice. And I just loved being in the Marine Corps, and I loved all the soldiers and sailors and airmen and everybody I served with. They're great people.
Really, in a certain sense, when we look at military justice, I mean, you look at it, and at first impression, you might say this is something that is so divorced from the traditional American justice system. But there was a study by the Bureau of Justice Statistics last fall, and that said that 3 out of 4 people who die in jail were never convicted of a crime. And that deals with issues of bail and detention, and right, it questions the notion of innocent until proven guilty. And I guess if we shift gears a little bit, obviously, our podcast has dealt with the first season of Serial and the case of Adnan Syed, and has dealt with these issues of bail and pretrial release. And I wonder, we've been talking so much about military justice and Bo Bergdahl, what's your overall take on the Adnan Syed case and the way in which that case was prosecuted?
I've probably said this before, and I've had some listeners come back and say, well, what do you mean? The question for me never is he factually innocent or guilty? Just because I've morphed into this lawyer mind over the past 2 decades, it seems to me that there are due process concerns about the validity of his conviction, where due process demands a retrial. And the two of you, I've learned tremendous amounts about. My favorite part of the law is the procedural portion. I love discovery. I love evidence. And so I've learned a tremendous amount from you. And I think that there's clearly some violations of the discovery obligations in his case and true questions about the competence of his counsel. I say that having at least 6 ineffective assistance of counsel motions filed on my cases when I was the defense attorney.
And I wonder, you know, you're talking about your role as defense counsel. The Taliban urination case I mentioned before, you were the prosecutor in that case, right?
Actually, I was neither. I would be the equivalent of the in-house attorney. So I was the deputy SJA, but the in-house counsel for the commander who was prosecuting the case.
What I wonder is, you know, you look at the Adnan Syed case and so many other cases. In fact, I just tweeted about this a few days ago, about this study that came out by the Innocence Project about prosecutors never really being punished for failing to disclose exculpatory evidence. There's the whole debate over making a murderer and the obligations on a prosecutor. In fact, the model rule of professional conduct that resulted in part from that case. When you were there in that urination case, and like so many people involved in criminal justice, I guess you weren't technically the prosecutor, but what was your mindset in that case? Someone who had been in the military his whole life, and then at that point you saw injustice, and it wasn't that you were defense counsel, and it wasn't that your client was being prejudiced and the documents were being withheld from him. It was, as you say, you were more of an independent role. So what was going through your mind when you made that decision to come forward and raise this complaint about the lack of discovery?
I take very, very seriously my obligations as a lawyer in all contexts. The prosecutorial power of the state is immense. And if our prosecutors and other government actors aren't fully compliant with all their Brady and other discovery obligations, we can't have any trust in the system. Unfortunately, I think things are getting better. But unfortunately, there's still a bit of an older mindset of, well, I'm not going to turn this over until the defense specifically asks for this document or this issue, which we all know that's not allowed. That is not the standard. You are obligated to turn over helpful information. All of your discovery obligations have to point towards that. And those were the type of games being played in those urination cases. And we even had Von Airy, the head of military justice for the Marine Corps, was withholding this information. And it just wasn't possible for me to move forward without that being rectified. Because I do care about our system, and all of us as lawyers, we've competed, we've got to where we've been in life, so we do have a desire to win, but that can never overshadow the prosecutor's absolute obligation to be turning over all of the possible helpful information. And I think you've nailed it on the head that there's very little ramifications for that. I think you did have in the Senator Stevens case from Alaska, there were a number of issues with discovery in those cases by the U.S. attorneys working that case. But even there, there were not serious punishments. And so it tends to be kind of covered up on the backside, I would say.
The risks are so low for prosecutors that it just is a matter of human nature. You have to expect that that's how the system's going to work. The system will naturally tend towards that sort of excess because there's no check on it. And it's not that prosecutors are bad people at all. They have a very difficult job, and most of the vast majority are great attorneys doing their best in a very difficult set of circumstances. But given that there is no punishment or no real pushback for cutting corners when it comes to discovery, of course it happens. Of course that's going to be more and more the norm. And until there is some kind of official pushback against it, just something more to give them incentive to actually abide by constitutional requirements. Without that, it's not going to get fixed.
It's got to be punishment. And I do feel for prosecutors, like you say, they're put in a difficult situation, but put on your big boy and big girl pants, and you need to deal with that. I dealt with that in the Noor Uthman Mohammed case for 805 days. And this kind of dovetails into the Bergdahl case. The reason those cases are so difficult to try is because you had a lot of classified investigation. You had our clandestine services, our three-letter agencies, you know, NSA, CIA, FBI, doing a lot of the investigation. They did a lot of the investigation in trying to recover Bergdahl, with the exception of the FBI. Those entities aren't normal law enforcement organizations. They don't understand, and it's difficult for them to comprehend turning over all of this evidence. And there's no excuse for it. That prosecutor owes a duty to our entire system to do it. It's difficult. Do it. It would be easier to just kind of make those stakeholders happy. Do it. And until there's actual ramifications for it, like you say, perfectly stated, that there's such a low chance of any punishment, you know, do I really want to rack my brain about this document? Do I really want to burn bridges with these coworkers I'm going to have to coexist with? Yes, you do. You have to.
And the issues you mentioned with the classified information, state secrets, that is also bleeding into the civilian world, too, with things like the Stingray issue, where in order to get technology that's military in nature, intelligence oriented, local and like state level law enforcement have to sign agreements saying they will not disclose this or they'll not give information concerning it. So this information is being withheld from purely domestic, run-of-the-mill civilian criminal matters because of the possible security implications.
Then stop using it. Then stop using it as a law enforcement tool, because we had that with radar and the stoplights. They had to turn it into more tickets instead of criminal matters. If you know beforehand that you're catching people, or be content as the government, be content that you're going to lose your cases. Because if you can't turn over that discovery, and if you can't let the cauldron of cross-examination determine how accurate these intelligence gathering tools are, don't use them for domestic law enforcement. Did everybody hear that? Is that, have I given a commandment to all of the?
I am so on board with that because it's just there is no middle ground here. You can't say we have a special license to not follow the Constitution here because we're using top secret military equipment. Like, that's not a thing.
Yeah, it absolutely should not be a thing. If you don't know how the pen register works, going back to, you know, older technologies, if you can't show how this device comes to this conclusion and the defense can't challenge that, challenge the validity of it, just don't use it then. Because there can't be a third way of this machine is very good at detecting, you know, who's criminality, but we can't tell you how the machine works. That's not the American judicial system.
But all you have to do is wave that flag that says state secrets, classified information. And there's naturally deference given. Courts, judges don't want to do something or make a decision that's going to have national security implications. And that does affect how this gets processed in the courts.
I think you absolutely have to have judges holding the government to account for that. And you have to have governmental officials that are honest about what are national security cases and what are just cases that would be domestic criminality. Because you can, going back to Pfalzgraf, you can say, well, selling a dime bag of weed on the street, that can fund international terror. So to fight that crime, this is international terrorism. And we could use state secrets to protect how we detected this person had a dime bag of weed in their pocket. But you shouldn't. We can't be doing that. Because it erodes 200 years of the judicial process in the United States.
One last question that I have. You noted the Task and Purpose website and also going forward, the scope of your podcast and about reintegrating people who are recent veterans back into society. And there's so many issues that could be addressed there. One thing that I found online in looking, and I've said before, one of the reasons I got into law was my grandfather was in World War II and he fought for years with the VA about getting benefits based upon multiple sclerosis that he believed he contracted in World War II. The piece that I found online was talking about people getting other than honorable discharges from the military. And I'm quoting from you in the article, "Across the services, we don't have a uniform standard for an other than honorable discharge. And I can understand the services differ on their desire for either more or less discipline, but that shouldn't determine what the service member gets later as far as medical and other assistance." I'm wondering, in terms of that, is there any type of legal standard? Is there any due process? Is there any movement there about the way that the discharge papers classify a person's discharge from the military?
Well, I've been working with a great guy from the NPR station down in Los Angeles, John Ismay, and we've been trying to work through that. And there's a lot of pro bono legal assistance helping that. But the fact is, it is not uniform across the services. Air Force, the Army, there's the Navy and Marine Corps, and they have different standards. Again, this is much like the revamping of the military justice system, that there should be a lot more uniformity, especially because the VA issue, that can cut people off from ever getting treatment. And at our bare minimum, we deserve to take people from our society who volunteer to go and fight. We deserve to make them as whole as we can when they return, or if not, assist them in getting whole. So if that's the most difficult ones are the injuries you don't see, and the idea that if a discharge that manifested itself with some sort of misconduct, usually low-level DUI, drug use, something along those lines, that we shouldn't strip them of a lifetime of PTSD treatment just because of that. And if we are, we need to make sure that we do it uniformly across the services.
Podcast Serial didn't just bring Adnan's case and Bo Bergdahl's case to the world. It also launched a new phenomenon in real crime. I think it's fair to say that when I was growing up, much of real crime was focused on murder mysteries that were featured on shows like Dateline and others in which the police, you know, through a series of really great investigations, got it right. They figured out who committed what crime. But what Serial did was launch an examination into when the police maybe don't get it right. And because of that, we were then brought shows like The Jinx on HBO and The Breakdown podcast that we heard about a couple of weeks ago. Many other podcasts and shows have now been made about possible wrongful convictions. This seems to be the new trend in real crime. And one of the most famous cases that has captured the imagination of the country and maybe even the whole world in the last 6 to 8 months was the feature on Netflix called Making a Murder. This was a series that was done about the Stephen Avery case, and it's something that we've been asked about many times to comment on. So join us next week when Susan Cullen and I discuss the Stephen Avery case. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Audio production by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the podcast Crime Writers On. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.